but it's not in mute. Ah, I can hear myself. Good. Right, oh, as usual, I have to clear up Steve's mess after him. Take that from him, okay. Right, oh, it's the afternoon session. You had a good lunch? Yeah. Plenty of coffee? Good. This is the difficult one, isn't it, when we're all ready for a bit of a nap? Me included, I know. And what did I choose to do? Oh, the end is near. but we'll get through somehow. Probably a slightly slower pace the way I'm feeling. But anyway, the end is near. Well, ish. Possibly. Maybe. Maybe not. Maybe not ever. Who cares? There's a range of attitudes towards the whole business of the topic of the end times. Perhaps from those very fanatically going around, I don't know if they do now, with sort of sandwich boards declaring the end is near, to those who, the moment they hear anything about this, just sort of go, well, who cares, maybe not, whatever. But I've got a few thoughts to share with you, and given the nature of this conference, it's on controversy. How could I refuse to do something on... Oh, the topics are gone, but certainly end times came up on it quite a lot. Okay, I've got a picture for you. I wonder what that is. Any idea? Well done, of course. It is Mount Everest, which is the world's highest mountain. Not the world's tallest mountain. Ooh. Anyone explain that for me? Yes. There's another... Yes, okay. There's a mountain called Mauna Kea in Hawaii that starts on the seabed. Okay. So it is taller... But because Everest starts on ground level, sea level, then it is higher. Okay, so it's a quiz question. There we are. But Mount Everest will do for me because it's generally known as being the tallest mountain, highest mountain anyway, not technically the tallest. Apparently it's still growing. Apparently it's a few centimetres a year. It must still be sort of being squashed up and so on. Well, why have you got that picture? Well, because the whole idea of looking at the end times is, I reckon, the Mount Everest of Christian theology. It's large, it's daunting, it's impressive, and it's there. Why do people climb mountains? Because they're there, they say. And this is a topic which, yes, it's big, it's huge, it's daunting, but it is there and it isn't going to go away. So we ought to at least be able to discuss it intelligently or give it some proper thought. I actually think this is probably, this whole topic is a classic case of 2,000 years of people thinking about it that's gone horribly wrong at times. In other words, it's been distorted by a lot of human thinking and made it even more complicated than ever before. I'm not going to be able to simplify it too much, but I want us at least to gain some insights. I've been teaching this in a couple of places and I tried a certain approach and we'll see what that's like. What's the best way to climb a mountain? Upwards, yeah, okay. Like, which way does the rain come from? It's downwards, yes, I know. Yes, it is good, well done. I'll remember that for next time, of course. Thank you very much. My answer was slowly, which is not quite as good now, I think about it. Anyway, how do you climb a mountain? Slowly, it's a long haul, it's not a sprint. And you have to be, realistic about it. Usually, you go in a team. You really don't go up Mount Everest on your own. You get a team, you get a guide, someone who's been there before. You get roped together. You know someone who knows the best way up, the best way to try it. And above all, beforehand, you have to be prepared. You don't just decide one day, I'm going up Mount Everest and off you go. You have to get yourself fully prepared. And you have to, I think, establish what's called base camp or something. Okay, and then you move on to the next camp. And so on. So today I'm taking you no further than base camp, even if we get that far, but it's worth having a sense about it. Now, when I teach this, this is my title. I call it The King Returns, because I like a nice, strong, positive title for this. I find the phrase end times a bit sort of gloomy. And the last days, I mean, that's just as bad, really, isn't it? So let's give it at least a nice, strong, positive title. that the king returns. The king is returning. Not everybody believes that these days, but the king is returning. So that's what were the main aim of all this. If he wasn't going to return, we wouldn't need to bother with this, but he is. And if you want to be really posh, of course, you can say you're studying eschatology, if you want an ology. Yeah, anyone want an ology? Remember the old advert? Okay, you've got an ology, you're a scientist or something. Okay. Well, if you want to be posh, you're studying eschatology, just from a word meaning last things and so on. I think in Hebraic thinking, the way it was described was the present age and the age to come. I like that. That keeps it quite simple. The present age, and then one day there's the age to come. So perhaps we can try and simplify it like that. Again, the phrase end times, which is part of our jargon, is not to be found anywhere in the scriptures. Again, not saying that necessarily makes it totally wrong, but it does mean, again, it's not sort of this chapter is on end times. The closest phrase, I think, is the times of the end. It's perhaps the same thing, perhaps. So, again, it's about putting lots of pieces together. So when you heard me announce that I was going to be talking about this afternoon, how did you feel? How did you feel? Did you feel, oh, great, exciting, this is just what I want? Did you feel, okay, I'll sit and listen, I'll put up with this? Did you feel, oh, good, a time to go to sleep, catch up on my sleep this afternoon? So part of the general question is, how do you feel about the future? How does the world around us feel about the future? What do you think are the key feelings that people have at the moment when they think about the future? What's your ideas on that? Fear. Yeah. I just want to say something else, I think. I didn't hear it. Fear and... Excited? Oh, anxiety. Yes, exactly. Anxiety. Yes, good. Fear and foreboding, I've put. But then I also put anxious as well. I think that is the predominant world understanding and thoughts about the future at the moment. They're getting a bit scared, and probably even on a daily basis more so. What's going to happen next? Terrorism, financial problems, disasters, war, threats of that again, and then there's always diseases, and everywhere confidence is being shaken. But that's mainly because it's been misplaced. And if people have placed their confidence on things in the future in the wrong place, then sooner or later it is going to let them down. That, I think, is the main one. Other people, though, are sort of fascinated by it. There's a sort of almost fanatical curiosity about the future. It's one of those strange things that we want to know and yet we don't really want to know. And yet we do want to know. But maybe we don't, but perhaps we do. So this is sort of inherent curiosity about all this, that we at least want to know something. So there's going to be a lot of speculation about the future. There's going to be a lot of trying to find things out, often in ways which are not very godly. Sometimes just by analysing trends of things, other times by perhaps trying to get involved in occult things and so on. But some people have a fascination about it. Other people might take a totally fatalistic view. Well, it's all decided anyway, don't need to worry about it, it's all predetermined. A bit sort of case sera sera about it. I would think that we should steer a better path than any of those as such. And our approach should be one of faith, which I think means finding the facts where we have them, finding as many facts as we can, but trusting God for the rest. And that's, I think, is a decent balance between the whole thing. But equally, I think we have a sense of responsibility to the next generation. If we don't think about it, if we don't pass on what we think we know and understand about it, we're letting them down. Because whatever is coming out there, it can't always be in the future. One day it's going to be in the present. Okay, it's going to get here one day. And if it's not in our time, then we have a sense of responsibility to make sure that we share something with others. So we don't go for fear or undue fanaticism or total fate. We try and find a faith path through it based upon facts, but also some trust. So largely, it's a topic, though, that is ignored. I don't know, unless you go to a place where they teach all this all the time, the chances are it never get mentioned at all. What are the reasons, do you think? Why is it ignored as a topic? Controversial, yeah, very good. And we don't want to upset people, do we? And if we start to teach something on it, then someone else is going to get offended. And like I said, it challenges your beliefs and so on. Any other reasons why it's ignored?
Because Jesus has already come back.
Oh, some people think, okay, it's already happened. So, yeah.
Because it's the favourite ground of strange
sects. Ah, like yes. Okay, yes. Okay, it's just... Yeah, it is indeed. That, yeah.
It takes a lot of effort.
It does. Okay, as I said, it is the Mount Everest, and I can't reduce the size of the mountain. Whether I can guide you up it in a slightly different way, we'll see, but I'm not tempted to do all that, obviously, today. But that's the first thing I put down. It's too complicated. Then I put too controversial, and alongside that, it's too dangerous to even go there because it will offend people. It will just create too many problems and so on. Another reason that I put down is that for many people it's just too frightening. Some people just don't want to think about this because this is not the sort of God we want to think about. It's not the sort of world we want to see happening. It's too frightening to even think about. It's too disturbing. We have to perhaps think about God in a different way and so on. And for many people as well, it's irrelevant. I've got my nice life to live and get on with it. Let's just do that. It's not going to happen yet. So let's just push it to one side. It's irrelevant. It's not going to happen yet. And maybe in their thinking, it's not going to happen at all, Jesus returning. I came across one survey, and it's only a small sort of sample size, but this was in an American seminary, I think, people being trained to lead churches, and only 80% believed that Jesus was going to physically return to planet Earth. I got that one way around. 80% didn't believe that Jesus was going to return to planet Earth. So how are the congregations going to come to terms with that? For some people, it's just now unbelievable. It's something that sort of belongs in the past. It was probably something that the early church could believe in, but now, after this great length of time, surely not anymore. Perhaps even it was just a bit of a ploy by Jesus to keep up the hopes of those he was leaving behind, keep them working for him. All sorts of different reasons come up to explain what's called the delay of his return, and that maybe it was a mistake. For many, then, this simply now belongs to an earlier form of Christianity, of thinking it simply won't happen now, too much time has passed, and we're far too sophisticated to even imagine anything like this. I wonder if that reminds you of a verse in 2 Peter. Yeah, and it's almost like this was expected, that as time went on, people will scoff and say, so where is this coming that he promised then? And you have to say, okay, that's an understandable perspective if you like, but just because there's been a delay doesn't mean that it isn't going to happen. God seems to work on a totally different timescale. But you won't find this sort of topic on the world's agenda. It's not going to be on any political platform. It won't be on the news, at least not yet. And in one sense, I don't mind the world scoffing. Almost inevitably, they will scoff if we mention it. But what I don't expect and don't like is if Christians or the church decide to scoff. Because we need to be ready. We need to be prepared. If there's one thing that comes through very clearly, it is always watch and pray. Be prepared, be ready. So it will not do to simply ignore what the Bible has to say. It's too important. And it's not a tack on the end sort of section of Christianity. You could say that the whole of Christianity is eschatological, if you want to use that word. It is forward moving. It's heading towards something. This is not just something that goes at the end like a happy ever after last chapter. The whole of our story is about the eventual return of Jesus. It's the characteristic feature of everything. And equally, therefore, it's not meant to be just for specialists and certainly not just for theologians. Even those that believe that theologians means oh get holy. Theology means oh get holy. But it's for everybody, should concern every Christian who at least should be able to clear away some of the weaker views and some of the other things that's cropped up and get some kind of basic understanding. Now, again, I'm not saying that this is easy and so on. But I've got another picture for you now. I think I have coming up. Yeah. I didn't know which to choose, so I choose both there. Approaches to the topic. Now, what do you see when you look at those, go bog-eyed or something, but or think of Doctor Who? But the one on the left is meant, well, they're both meant to be spirals, really. Okay, or concentric circles. My point here is that I think the best overall approach to the topic is you don't just dive in, but you're prepared to go round it several times and build up your knowledge and understanding. In other words, you start with a basic overview. Just get some simple facts in place, first of all. Just simply like, the king is returning. That's a basic initial fact. In fact, I can sum up the book of Revelation for you in two words. Jesus wins. Get a basic facts in place. Get it sorted like that. Go round slowly the first circle. Then add more details and slowly start to spiral or circle outwards. That's the approach that I would take. Don't dive into the whole thing to start with. It's a little bit like trying to put together a jigsaw puzzle. Don't know if any of you do jigsaw puzzles these days. I've done for ages, but I used to. So, anyone, what's the biggest jigsaw puzzle you've ever done? Thousands, is that all? Anyone done more? 3,000? Any more? Oh, top of a double bed. That must be getting to be quite a big size. 10,000, I've never done a 10,000, but you can have 10,000-piece jigsaw puzzles. Okay, 10,000-piece jigsaw puzzle. This is like not just a 10,000-piece jigsaw puzzle, but it's like a box of a 10,000-piece jigsaw puzzle with another 10,000 pieces added from lots of other puzzles. And you've got about six different puzzles all mixed in there, and you don't even know what the picture is. So best of luck on that one. In other words, what I'm saying here is that almost we have too much data, too many clues, too many things to sort out. And typically, they're scattered throughout the whole of the Bible, sometimes in the New Testament, in the Gospels, some in the letters, and some in the book of Revelation, and so on. So it really is still a very complex thing to deal with. But if you start simple, get some simple facts in place first, that you can rely on, you know these are facts, then maybe you can start to add more onto it later. So if you want to know about the third trumpet in Revelation, just wait a little while, you'll get there eventually. I'm not an artist, I haven't attempted to draw anything, I don't think, so far today, but I'm not an artist. But when I was a child, I could draw and paint very well, because I used to do join the dots. Yes. And then I graduated on from there to painting by numbers. I didn't become an artist, I became a mathematician. There must have been something about the numbers that attracted me more than anything else. But it's an approach. Can we at least find some dots to join? Get some dots numbered and draw an outline, and then maybe fill in a bit here and fill in a bit there and see the picture emerge. Maybe that is the approach to sort of take. Join the dots to start with, get some things in order, joined up. So I decided when I was going to teach that, this thing, what my approach would be, and that was to start in the Gospels, not start at the book of Revelation. I think that's the worst place you can start when you're trying to get end time stuff sorted out. And so I said, we're going to pretend we're one of the disciples of Jesus, and we're going to sit at his feet and listen carefully to what he said, first of all. So I called it the Join John approach. If you're going to pick a disciple to pretend we are, then why not pick John? Because he's the one that's going to end up in Patmos and so on. But we start in the Gospels with what Jesus taught on the Mount of Olives. It's called the Olivet Discourse, if you understand that. So let's put ourselves in the sandals of John and see what he learnt simply by listening to Jesus. Start there. Don't dive in to other more complicated things. I mean, that is quite complicated enough, but at least it's where I think we should start, because we are disciples of Jesus and we want to follow the way he said things. So let's pretend that we are one of his disciples and join John in this particular journey. But of course, John was Jewish, young Jewish lad. So everything that he was listening to from Jesus, he had a background. He could filter it through the Hebraic background that he had because he knew the Old Testament and he would really know it. He would have learnt it and understood it and so on. So after we've gone through what the Gospels say about it, what Jesus says about his return, then we have to think back into the Hebraic background and think what John would already have known. So how wonderful you've just read the book of Daniel, because now you've entered into the Hebraic background. John would have known the book of Daniel. What other parts of the Old Testament would you regard as being essential for getting background to this?
Zechariah.
Okay. Zechariah. Jeremiah. Okay. Yeah, okay. Amos. Well, obviously, there's lots of bits and pieces in lots of different prophets, but certainly the end section of Zechariah, quite a bit of Ezekiel, and bits of Isaiah, and so on. So we actually then spent a long time trying to go back and say, what would John already have known and understood, and how could he match that up with things that Jesus mentioned? I suppose a classic one was the abomination of desolation, which comes up in the book of Daniel, and so on. And then when you've gone through all of that, and you're probably then still partly up the mountain, if far at all, then, well, what did John actually then do? He just sort of got on with his Christian life. He got on with serving Jesus, he got on with looking after churches, and several decades later, persecution came along and he was put on the island of Patmos, and then suddenly he got this massive new download as Jesus turned up and gave him a further revelation, a further extra thing. But he already had everything that Jesus had taught him before, everything he knew from the Old Testament background, and years of serving him and thinking within the church and so on. So that's been the approach that I've taken with people as we join John. First of all, what John heard from Jesus, what John knew from the Tanakh, and then finally what John saw and heard from Jesus at Patmos. It's trying to put things together in an order which makes a little bit more sense, perhaps. And of course, it's totally scriptural. In other words, I said, I'm not interested in what someone else has said for the time being. We are going to examine the scriptures from this point onwards. Okay, you might have read this, you might have heard it said that, and so on. You just forget that for the moment. We are going to follow this path through the scriptures. But before we set off, I said, we need to establish base camp. And what that means is that on this very difficult journey, with different paths as we go along, you're going to be faced with choices from time to time. So every so often the path will sort of fork or change direction. And we have to think about the choices. If you make them in advance, then you've got a bit of a better chance of getting up the mountain. But I made two things that I said was essential for them, two pleas that I made. If you make a certain decision, you'll see what these decisions are in a moment, then you must be prepared to accept the consequences of your decision, and you must also, please, be consistent. Now, what I meant by that was that if suddenly you're faced with a choice of A, B or C, and it's followed by D, E or F, if you choose path A, then don't expect path F, because they don't join. Okay? You've got to be consistent and accept the consequences of the choices that you make. That'll become clear with some illustrations in a minute, because I haven't told you what the choices are. But please, don't pick and choose. Don't say, I want to go up that bit of the path, that seems right, and then suddenly it gets difficult and say, oh no, I don't want that, I'll jump across that. It doesn't work. You'll get very confused. So, what sort of choices are we talking about? Well, the first one is, what are you going to make of what are called unfulfilled prophecies? Someone told me off about that and said, can you please call them yet-to-be-fulfilled prophecies? So I said, okay, that's better, fine. But whenever you meet a prophecy that clearly hasn't yet been fulfilled, what are your choices? One is that, well, it was never really meant to happen anyway. It was one of several options. It was conditional. If this had happened, then that would have happened. It didn't, so this isn't going to happen. End of story, put it to one side. It was just there as a possibility. So is that how you're going to treat unfulfilled or yet to be fulfilled prophecies? Or are you going to say, well, actually, it's already happened, but it's not happened in the way that it was written about. It's happened in a spiritual way. A little bit like saying Jesus has already come back. How has he come back? Well, spiritually, maybe at Pentecost or at other times and so on. So we're sort of avoiding it by saying, well, it's actually happened. We didn't really know it's happened, and it's not happened quite as it was predicted. But it's happened, so that's one way around it. The other way, of course, yes, one day, what you read is still going to happen, literally, at some point in the future. Now, each of these choices or approaches to this kind of prophecy has some difficulties attached to it. There will happen someday, literally one, still has some difficulties attached to it, even though it's the one that I think probably most of us will want to pursue. Because actually, if it's going to happen someday, literally, then we've got to think, how is that going to happen? How do we get from here to there? What's going to make it happen? It still doesn't make it terribly easy. In fact, probably just saying it's already happened is a bit of a cop-out, although you've still got to explain how that's happened. Let me give you an example. This passage in Isaiah 65, and there's another passage in chapter 11, verses 6 and 7. So it's Isaiah 65, 25, and 11, 6 and 7. And it's usually sort of shortened and characterised by the lion will lie down with the lamb. Have you heard that? It's actually a bit more involved than that, if you read it. It's the wolf and the lamb will feed together and the lion will eat straw like the ox. Or the wolf will live with the lamb and the leopard will lie down with the goat. The cow will feed with the bear, the young will lie down together, and so on. So usually just symbolised as the lion will lie down with the lamb. So what are you going to say about that? Well, that's a nice idea, it's a nice prediction. It might have happened, but it just isn't going to happen like that anymore because the right conditions haven't happened. Maybe if Messiah had sort of come in the first place and established the kingdom, messianic age and so on, then something like that might have happened. But it's not an option anymore. It's conditional. The more sort of spiritual it's already happened one is, well, of course, these aren't real animals. These represent different types of people. And when they're in the body of Christ, we all get on so well together, the lion-like person and the lamb-like person, they're all at one in peace and harmony because they're all part of the body of Christ. It's a way of just saying that, the church verger will get on with the church organist and things like that. You try and find a spiritual answer to it. The other one, of course, is one day when Jesus returns, there'll be a new heaven and a new earth, and we'll actually see it happen. But I say, you've got to then think, how do we get there? What's going to make that difference? But I think that's an illustration of how people tackle prophecies that are yet to be fulfilled in different ways. One, basically, it isn't going to happen now. It was okay then to suggest that, but not anymore. One is that we can find a way of suggesting that it has already happened. And another way is to say, well, we're looking for it still to happen in one way. So I think that's a major choice to make when you start off. How are you going to regard unfulfilled prophecies? Be consistent as well. It's no good saying, oh, I want that one still to happen, but that one I think I'll spiritualise into something else. You can't pick and choose your path up the mountain. Pick one and stick with it. And the next one, the really big one here, what are you going to make of Israel and the Jews? This really is the big one that makes a huge difference to people. I mean, fortunately, most people I teach, I've already done all the Hebraic root stuff and they're familiar with where I'm coming from and all this. But you could say there's two main choices, you know them so well. One is that God has finished with the Jews, he's replaced them. Another is that they remain central to God's plans, therefore he is going to restore them, and so on. So these are two diametrically opposite, and they take totally different paths up the mountain. And I usually say, if you want to choose the replacement option, don't be surprised if you fall off the mountain at some point. I'll let them know where I stand pretty early on. But anyway, if you choose that, fine, but you're going to really struggle with some of the other parts of it. Some people say, oh, I like a middle option. They're around, but they're just another nation. They're not that special anymore, but they're still around. They may still have something to do with it. Well, if you want to fudge it, fine, but there we are. But I make that clear. This is a big choice. Make your choice. It will affect the way you go up the mountain. Another one. Whenever you come across end time stuff, if you read Daniel today, you'll know about it so much. There's a lot of symbolism. There's a huge amount of symbolic stuff in this, whether it's numbers or beasts or different things. What on earth is going on? And you need to make a decision how to deal with symbolism. Are you happy to leave it symbolic, or do you actually look for a literal understanding of it? I've put a couple of references there to Revelation. At one point in Revelation, I think this might be the two witnesses, fire comes from their mouths and devours their enemies. Real fire? Or are they just saying something? Are they words? What actually is happening here? Is it actually real fire coming from their mouths? Probably not. When Jesus returns, out of his mouth comes a sharp sword with which to strike down the nations. Are we physically going to see a sword coming out of his mouth? Or does it symbolise something else? I'm very happy with symbolism and a lot of it. I don't worry about it too much. I let it be symbolism. Okay? Some symbols will be obvious. Some symbols get explained as you read about them. Others remain very obscure. Can't do anything about it. But you're going to meet a lot of symbolism. Face that as part of your preparation and decide what it is that you want to do with it when you meet it. Most people are happy with the idea that there's a lot of things that are purely symbolic in all this. And then what you do with that, you have to discuss. Another choice I make with them is decide how much certainty you really want. And I think this is coming back a little bit to the Greek versus Hebrew side of things. How much certainty do you actually want? Or to put it another way, how much uncertainty can you live with? You get some people who try for a complete system. They want to have everything absolutely worked out, everything in the right place, everything organised, everything sorted out. Sort of person that stands up here and says, I've spent 40 years studying this, and now at last I can tell you what it's all about. And I'm not impressed. I go, 40 years? Has it really taken 40 years? It's not that complicated, surely. If it takes 40 years, there's something gone wrong. I'm not saying it doesn't take time, it's not difficult. But have you tried to be too certain about everything? Have you tried to produce a complete systematic approach to things where actually we're meant to live with a certain amount of uncertainty? I think we discussed in the Yeshiva, didn't we, about how God reveals certain things and keep other things secret to himself. Okay? You have to put up with that. You have to put up with that. So a certain amount of uncertainty, that's a phrase, I think still works quite well. One other choice, and some of you might be familiar with this, because I've got this and greatly influenced by David Pawson on this. He talks about the shape of history. He calls it, well, you can call it the philosophy of history or the meaning of history. In other words, what is history actually about? What is happening here? What shape is it? Some pictures to help you. Is history on an upward path? Okay, is this the way that history is going? This is called the progressive view of history, the optimistic view, the upward view. I think this is the main view that people today have of history. Okay, upwards and onwards. Every politician promises you it's going to get better, it's going to get better. Everything is about progress. Progress is a key word today. In fact, it's even an idol, actually. I think progress has become a bit of an idol. But this is a view of history that a lot of people are pursuing. It might not look quite like that. It might be, it might look a bit more curvy, a bit more wavy. Might be a few ups and downs on the way. But basically, this is the evolutionary, progressive view of history that says, well, on the up and up and up, somehow we're doing fine. And one day we'll reach the stars, and that's where our destiny will be. The Bible doesn't necessarily talk about history in those terms. It can talk about it as a flat line. People do. People might look at a flat line. More likely to think of it a bit sort of circular. It's just going round and round and round. History goes round and round. And this was a typical ancient view. It was actually the Greek view of history that says everything seems to go round and round in circles, so presumably our history is going round and round in circles. So we're just like on a big magic roundabout, and we wonder quite, we don't know how it began, we don't know how we're going to get off, we don't know how it's going to end, and so on. That's the circular view of history. I think you find this parodied in the book of Ecclesiastes, and I think he's parodying it because he says all the time about things going round and round in circles and cycles of nature and so on. There's nothing new under the sun. Everything's just going round and round like that. Now, under those pictures of history, whether it's upwards, curvy, going round in circles, you've got a problem. You don't know where Jesus is going to come back into that. In fact, in some cases, there's no need for him. What's the point? If everything's going up and up and up, then why does Jesus need to come back? What's he coming back for? Same with the circular view. But the view of history that the Bible teaches is the apocalyptic view, And that looks something like that. Please, my drawings are not intended to be any kind of scale, any kind of predictive path of anything like that. It's just a picture of a shape. And that means that at some point, things will take a huge downward turn. And they will hit a bottom point. And then something will happen, which is catastrophic. And at that point onwards, everything levels off higher than it was before. Okay, I think that's the best picture of this. It's called the apocalyptic view of history. It's the one that says we're heading for a big downer at some point, but after that, things will get better and remain better forever. And again, David Pawson points out that this was the view of history that was held by the Jews, because they were looking for the Messiah to come and create the Messianic Age. It was also the view of communists, or Marxists anyway. Marxists believing that the capitalist system will one day collapse, come the revolution, brother, and everything will go up, and then we've established heaven on earth, so to speak. And also it should be the view of Christians, because whereas the Jews are saying what will make the difference is Messiah coming, we're saying it's when he comes back. So we share a common shape of history. And in fact, the reason that the book of Revelation is literally called the Apocalypse, it's the opening Greek word, is quite simply because it has an apocalyptic view of history. The only question is for us, what makes that change? What makes that sudden transformation from the big dip into the complete change and staying the same forever? And that, of course, is the return of Jesus. So one of the choices, the final choice, is what's your shape of history? Whatever you feel about it, ask yourself this. Where in your scheme of things would Jesus return? Because if you've got an upward one, when's he going to come back? How does that make sense? If it's going around in circles, where does he join? Does that make sense? But if it's the big dip and the sudden change, then that's a good one for understanding where he would come back. But the big question in all this, and it's one I leave with you, and you can discuss it, is why does Jesus bother to come back at all? Why should he? I mean, he's doing okay where he is, isn't he? He's nicely in heaven. He's seated at the right hand of the Majesty on high. What's he got to come back for? Surely we can just die and go to heaven. Isn't that what it's all about? Why should he return at all? They're key questions. There's some interesting answers. I'd like you to think about that. We can discuss them afterwards. But as well as why should he return, that's, by the way, far more important than when. When is the least important question you can usually ask. I'll talk about time later tonight, perhaps. But when isn't usually the main question. Why is always more important. If you know why he's going to return, you're halfway towards understanding things. The other interesting question, though, is who? Who is going to actually return? Well, it's Jesus. Okay, fine. What kind of Jesus? When he comes back, is he still a Jewish Jesus? Wow. Now that will shock the world. That will be controversial. You mean, if Jesus is coming back, he's still Jewish? Think about that one. Someone wrote a book called When a Jew Rules the World. It's a very good book. Recommend it. But it's understanding, when Jesus comes back, is he still Jewish? And if you want to tell me that he's not still Jewish, I want you to tell me, at what point did he change? Okay? Think about it. If he's no longer Jewish, when he returns he's no longer Jewish, find me a point somewhere in his story, through the scriptures, when he changed. So, here's the key questions. Why does he need to return? That will solve a lot of the problems. And when he returns, who exactly is he? What kind of Jesus will he be? Well, I say he's going to be the Jewish Jesus. Right, well, my time's up and I've said everything that I really wanted to say in this session. Obviously, it opens up a lot of more chat and so on. But we'll certainly do that for there. Okay, well done for seeing through that. If you stayed awake, even better. If you've had enough, I don't blame you. I'm nearly ready for mine now, actually. Okay. Thank you, then. I think it's worth doing.